Hello, this is The Good Robot Andes, Season 1, Episode 7. My name is Andy Balaam, and this is...
Andy Cockerill.
And the film that we're going to be talking about today is...
Sorcerer.
And I had not heard of the film Sorcerer until you mentioned it to me earlier today that that's what we're going to be talking about. So simply based on its title, I'll give you a quick plot summary and review. Based on no other knowledge, it's there's a series of books which are basically a cash-in on the Harry Potter books called Sorcerer, and then this is the film that is the cash-in on the Harry Potter films. They don't have the soul of the Harry Potter books. The writer doesn't understand that the thing about Harry Potter is it's about growing up, it's about being a child and those kinds of feelings and growing up feelings and all that stuff. They think it's about like potions and costumes and things like that. So the films are really very empty, completely forgettable. And I have no idea why you would want to talk about that film on this podcast.
Okay. Well, you'd probably be right if I did want to talk about that film on this podcast, but I don't. I actually want to talk about a film from 1977. Directed by William Friedkin, who also made The Exorcist and French Connection, among others.
And obviously that came out before Harry Potter.
Very much so, yes. Mm-hmm. Before even, I think, possibly even... actually, I don't know about when J.K. Rowling was born, but it might possibly have been made before then as well.
Surely yes. She's not. Surely she was born then.
Surely.
Come on.
Surely you can't be serious. Anyway... So Sorcerer was released in 1977 in the same week that Star Wars was released, largely forgotten for many, many years. You could only get it on pretty rotten VHS or bad DVD releases until 2 years ago when it was it 2 years ago? Maybe it was last year, when it was released finally on a restored Blu-ray. Which is what I've watched. Mm-hmm. I watched that today, actually, just before this recording. I decided to refresh my memory of the film. The first time I watched it, I'll just digress slightly. The first time I watched this, I'd had a ruptured eardrum, which was very painful, and I was on codeine and paracetamol, cocodamol. Uh-huh. And I watched this film when I was, shall we say, chemically enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite an experience, I have to say.
Okay, so it's a film that benefits from altered perception.
Yeah, possibly, although I watched it today and I really enjoyed it, having mastered an unaltered state. Mm-hmm. So I think it works, as some people say, on many levels. Uh-huh. Sorcerer is the second adaptation of a book called The Wages of Fear, and Friedkin decided to make this after the success of The French Connection. Do you know anything about The French Connection?
I've heard of it, but I've got no idea. It sounds like the kind of thing I don't like, so I've never watched it.
Okay, well, what do you think it's about, just briefly?
I don't know, it sounds like the Three Colours films or something like that.
Okay.
Although, actually, I did quite like the Three Colours films, but anyway. That's...
It's nothing like those. It's a it's a film set in New York. It's a couple of cops, vice cops, played by Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider, who is also in Sorcerer, and who was in Jaws in 1975 Chief
that's
Brody.
That's absolutely nothing like what I thought it was like.
And it's a really gritty cop thriller.
Right.
Maybe
I should watch it.
It's really good, French Connection. Right. And, you know, Friedkin, in the space of two films, he redefined how people would make that type of film up until now, and probably forever.
Which two films are these?
The French Connection and The Exorcist.
Wow. Right. So The Exorcist is amazing.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
And I think, you know, the decision by Warner Brothers to give The Exorcist to Friedkin was a stroke of genius, because he brings that gritty real-world tone to a supernatural story and makes it gives you something to believe in. And in fact, the scariest parts for me of The Exorcist are when there's no supernatural stuff going on. It's when Chris McNeil is in the hospital and she's losing her mind, you know, saying, I just don't know what to do anymore. That thing in the bedroom is not my daughter, this kind of thing. That's when it's at its most powerful.
It's just making me think, talk about the grittiness, it's making me think of the bit where it's really cold. And he's got that special effect of it looking like it's really cold by making it really cold.
And of course, these days they do that with CGI like they did in Fight Club.
Yeah, and the actors are like shivering and stuff. You know, you can't fake that.
It's amazing, brilliant, isn't it? It's a dedication to realism that most directors these days would probably get fired for.
And people wouldn't normally, as you say, people wouldn't bring that kind of gritty realism to that kind of story.
No, because that kind of story wasn't taken seriously by Hollywood or indeed by, you know, moviegoers at large until The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And he made that type of thing legitimate. So anyway, the digression over, we're talking about Sorcerer. So he decided he wanted to make this. He felt he was on a bit of a roll. So he decided to remake The Wages of Fear, which is a film about four outcasts from varied backgrounds who meet in a South American village where they are assigned to transport crates of nitroglycerin, which is quite unstable. This stuff's not been stored very well. And they had to transport it to an oil well that is on fire in order to put out the fire. And right.
They're going to pour nitroglycerin on an oil fire.
Yes, in order to seal the thing. Right. Literally fighting fire with fire.
Huh.
Apparently, this works. They're going to blow up the oil head.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess if there's enough of an explosion,
it
gets rid of all the oxygen. And
puts out the fire. So this is set in Colombia, in the 1970s, which looks like a not very nice place to be by all accounts. And these four people have arrived there by various different means, but they're all there because they're on the run from something. So there's a hitman who's on the run, or is he? There's a guy who's on the run from the mob in America. There's a banker who has bankrupted his bank and is on the run from the authorities in France. And there's a terrorist who has been responsible for a bombing in Jerusalem, who is also on the run. And they've all ended up in the same village.
They're a motley bunch.
They are a very motley bunch indeed. And none of them look like they want to be there. And they're all very shifty, and they all look at the police, who look like they could be bribed quite easily, but probably for quite a lot of money, which they don't have. And they're looking for a way out. They're looking to try and go somewhere else apart from this. This place that it's kind of displayed as a kind of purgatory for these people.
Right.
And their ticket out is the oil company that wants to pay four people who can drive trucks a lot of money by local standards to drive these trucks full of unstable nitroglycerin to go and close the oil well.
They've got to get them there. They need someone.
They need desperate people.
Yeah, someone who doesn't value their own life that highly.
Pretty much. Although they value it enough to want to try and survive this and get out. They're not altruistic.
No.
At all, these people. In fact, they're all exactly the opposite of being altruistic. So that is the plot. And,
and do they know each other before this all
starts? No, they're all complete strangers.
They're all in this village.
Yep.
They all respond to the advert.
They all respond to the advert, and there's quite a nice montage scene where you see them all driving these trucks, looking quite deranged.
Okay, so this is interesting. So, like, what did you say the book was called?
The book is called The Wages of Fear.
Right, because you see that? You see, what I'd expect someone who'd done The Exorcist to want to do would be something with some weight and some meat. And this sounds like a fairly ordinary story. But then a book that's called The Wages of Fear, that does sound quite meaty.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with this film, and there are many problems with this film, but one of the problems with it is the title, which actually turns out to be, I discovered today, I noticed for the first time, is the name of one of the trucks. It's called Sorcerer. Okay. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, there is no reason for this film to be called Sorcerer. And it may have contributed to the fact that it failed so badly at the box office.
And that wasn't even the original name. So.
No.
He didn't have to use it.
No. But what the film does have going for it is, you know, Friedkin's trademark gritty shooting style. He shoots... I was reminded when I watched it today, he shoots in a style very similar to Robert Altman. Have you heard of Robert Altman?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he shoots with a lot of long lenses, like Altman used to.
Lots of long shots.
Lots of shots that are held for quite a long time. He also shoots with a long lens that's actually a zoom lens and then zooms in on the subject. Really up close, you know, up so you can see like the pores in their face kind of close, right. Which is really interesting.
And how did it look in the restored Blu-ray?
It looks beautiful.
Right, okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of scenes where it's a little bit grainy, but for the most part, it looks absolutely stunning, which is really great because I've seen some pretty rotten Blu-ray supposed restorations,
right,
and this one is really something quite special.
So why is he shooting so close in and far away?
Well, I think he wants to show how isolated these people are, even though they're in this village where there's a lot of people. They don't speak the language and they're on the run. And, you know, effectively you are alone in a crowd.
Yeah, right, okay.
They're all alone in a crowd, basically. Yeah. But there's some fantastic cinematography in this film. Really, some of it's really quite stunning. He captures the chaos and danger of the jungle, really with real power. And I've been to last year, went to Peru, and went to the Amazon jungle, to a place called Puerto Maldonado. And although Puerto Maldonado was nothing like the village that's portrayed in Sorcerer. I can see the parallels, and the feeling I got from being in Puerto Maldonado was this was a place where anything could happen
on any given
day because it's so far away from anywhere else.
Right,
and that's the impression you get in Sorcerer, is that this place is so far removed from everywhere else that pretty much anything could happen in this village and nobody would ever know.
Right. So do they spend a lot of time in the village, or is it mostly them driving the trucks? Or?
I'd say about half of the film is a setup in the village. There's also a lot of setup with the oil company trying to figure out what they're going to do.
Okay.
There's a very nice scene where an explosives expert examines the nitroglycerin and... looks at the top of it and says, yeah, this seems okay, it looks dry, and then he puts his hand down the side of the crate and it comes out wet. And he sort of backs away from it and flicks this stuff into the forest and it explodes. And he says, I don't know how you're going to move this. You can't put it on a helicopter because it's too bumpy. So they decide to...
What we need is a banker, a terrorist.
Yeah. A mob, someone on the run from the mob, and a hitman. That's what we need. We need four guys who are at the end of the world and the end of their tether. We need these guys.
I'm getting the band back together.
Yes, we're gonna blow up, man.
We're gonna blow up a thing.
An oil fire. Oh well.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting about it, and it's very cool. Is that Tangerine Dream scored the film. I don't know if you've heard of them.
I think I have.
Okay. So they were, or are, I'm just, yeah, so they were soundtrack composers and sort of electronic prog rock pioneers from the 1970s. And he loved their music so much that he didn't even finish the film. He just said to them, I want you to just write me some music for this film. This is what it's about. So they went ahead and wrote a score, and then he scored the film based on what they gave him.
Right, so he actually edited it to fit with the music.
Yeah, and it's really great. The music is, I mean, Tangerine Dream were, I think that maybe they're still going, I'm not really sure, but were, or are, you know, real pioneers of electronic music. Analog electronic music, as it would have been at that time.
Yeah.
It would have been, you know, capacitors and resistors and that kind of thing, rather than circuit boards. So the soundtrack is excellent. They also scored, a couple of other things, but there's a film that they scored. One sec.
So that doesn't sound rubbish retrospectively then, because some of these things that were quite innovative at the time, you kind of wish they hadn't done later.
Yeah. Tangerine Dream, I'll come back to that, but I was just finished off my train of thought there. They also scored a movie called The Keep for Michael Mann. You know Michael Mann, who made Miami Vice and...
Right, yeah, oh, yeah, I thought the name rang a bell, yeah.
I think it was his first feature, or certainly an early feature for him, was a movie called The Keep, which is a sort of sci-fi horror thing set during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really, really like, but has never had, I don't think it's ever had a DVD, they've never had a DVD release because of rights issues with the Tangerine Dream score.
Oh, right, okay.
So, you know, I've been waiting for a long time for some kind of digital release of The Keep, and I don't think it's ever going to happen, unfortunately, which is a shame because it's a really great film. Who's in it? I'm trying to think who's in it now. It's Sir Ian McKellen, or Ian McKellen as he was back then, is in it. Mm-hmm. Gabriel Byrne.
Oh, gosh, okay.
Scott Glenn. It's a really good cast, and it's got a creepy, creepy tone to it. It's set in a castle keep in Eastern Europe in the Second World War, and it's about the rise of a golem, you know, like a Jewish supernatural being, a Hebrew supernatural being, I should say. I think it's really good. You know, it's corny and a bit silly, but it works.
Right. Sounds good.
It's corny and silly in the way that The Omen is corny and silly, you know.
Yeah.
But that works.
Yeah, it really does.
It really does. So back to Sorcerer. Yes.
Does the soundtrack stand the test of time?
On Sorcerer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does. I think that it's very effective. It's certainly as effective, possibly more so, than a big sweeping orchestral score would have been on a film like this. Because this film seems to have a strange, sort of almost surreal tone to it. It seems to exist in a world... It seems to exist in a world that is out of step with our own.
Right.
In the way that, you know, Friedkin has kind of crafted a reality that's not quite our own reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, the fact that these four people are in this place is such a coincidence.
Mm. Yeah.
But it all works because they all look utterly desperate and they all just want to get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So
they get they find the advert. Well, yep. Hang on. Well, the oil well's on fire. They got the nitroglycerin. Blah 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 blah. It's unstable. They put an advert. They respond to the advert.
Yeah. They pick them.
They get all right. They pick them. They get them in the trucks. They drive. Yeah.
So they drive. There's two things. There's two obstacles in their way. And one of those is a very rickety road that's been held up by bits of wood.
Right.
That's a very effective sequence.
Right.
In which one of the trucks, one of the front wheels, suddenly drops through this wooden structure.
Mm-hmm.
Which jars the truck.
Yeah.
And there's one guy outside who's leading the truck forward and there's another one driving. And I'd seen this before, obviously, and I literally just stopped breathing for a few seconds. I thought, okay, and nothing happens. You know, it doesn't blow up.
Yeah.
And they managed to get out of that. And then there's a really, really great sequence where they realize they're on the wrong road and they've got to cross a bridge that's held up with ropes and is falling apart, basically. It's not
trucks.
It's not a rope bridge. You know, it's a bridge designed for cars, but it's falling apart.
Right.
It's a suspension bridge made out of rope.
Right.
And again, the first truck manages to make it over. But because it's gone over, it's kind of caused the bridge to start disintegrating.
Yeah.
So the second one uses like a winch on the front, like on a Land Rover,
mm-hmm.
which they tie to a tree and then they pull that one across. And that's really, really intense sequence. And it's raining. Obviously, it's raining all the time because they're in the jungle. So they both get out of that and they carry on. And then... the truck that's in front.
So hang on there. There are two trucks or four trucks?
There's two trucks and four men. Yeah, and they swap driving and they support each other. Kind of support each other. They actually don't like each other very much.
Right.
Neither of them wants to drive and neither of them wants to navigate. And it's just this constant battle of wills between these four men who don't really want to be there, but this is all they can do to get out kind of thing.
Okay.
So there's a truck in front that's driving along a mountain pass, like a switchback, and they have a blowout.
Right.
And it goes over the edge and explodes. So the first truck blows up in a massive fireball that's really quite impressive.
Okay, so that's two of them dead.
That's two of them dead and a truck gone. So the second truck comes through. They pass by all the debris and horribly charred bodies and that kind of thing. Then they get held up by, I think, what must be FARC rebels in Colombia at the time. But they manage to get away with it because the hitman's got a gun and he shoots the rebels. But he himself gets shot. So Roy Scheider's on his own. Chief Brody's on his own now, just like at the end of Jaws. And he's got to carry on. And he then drives into an area that looks like it's got nothing to do with Colombia. It actually looks like an area of Turkey called Cappadocia, which is sort of like a very desert-like environment with strange desert formations in it. And he delivers the nitroglycerin by hand after the truck basically stops working.
Right.
And we don't see what happens after that. We then see... It then fades to black, and we see him being given a new identity by the mining company, or at least a new passport.
Is he the one on the run from the mob?
Yes.
Right.
And a check, to which he says, "I can't cash this check. Why are you giving me this check?" And he says, "Well, we'll fly you to the nearest bank, then you can cash it, and then you can get out of here."
Mm-hmm.
And after they say this, the camera goes to the outside and pans back, and we see a car arrive with three guys in smart suits, and they go into the bar, and then the film ends. So we're presuming that they are the mob, and they've finally caught up with him, and they're probably going to whack him right then and there. So that's how the film ends. You know, it's quite a downer of an ending, really. It's not a happy ending by any means.
It's quite a downer of a film generally.
It is quite a downer of a film. I think, though, that although it is quite dour, what makes it is the visuals and the music. Mm-hmm. And the performances are really good.
Right. Do you think Friedkin saw in it? Why did he want to remake it?
I don't really know. I mean, I haven't really gotten to the bottom of why he wanted to do it, but I think that I look at the French Connection, in which the main character in that is a character called Popeye Doyle, played by Gene Hackman, who is a real obsessive character. And we then fast forward to The Exorcist, where Chris McNeil is also a really obsessive character. I think he sees something in movies, rather like Darren Aronofsky does, who made Requiem for a Dream, which you and I have only seen once, and Black Swan and other things.
Is Black Swan made by the same person?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I see, because it sounds like very much the same kind of... would probably be better for your mental state to just nail some part of you to a table instead of watching it.
I loved Black Swan. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it, and I think... I don't know. I feel attracted to it. But if it's like Requiem for a Dream, then really, it's just a bad idea.
It's not like Requiem for a Dream. Okay. But anyway, I'm digressing slightly. But the point that I'm getting here is that I think that Friedkin and Aronofsky share a kind of worldview that they like central characters who are really driven by one thing. And there may be more than one central character who's really driven by one thing, but they both like that. And in this case, Friedkin is fascinated by these four guys who've ended up in the middle of nowhere and want to get out of the middle of nowhere and get somewhere else.
I'm wondering whether he saw it at a sort of formative time of his childhood.
Maybe. I mean, The Wages of Fear was released in 1953, so yeah, it's quite possible that he did, or maybe as a teenager. And it left quite an imprint on him.
So given a completely free hand, he chose a story of four nasty guys
who drive trucks.
And
it tanked
and died.
It absolutely tanked. It had a budget of $15 million to begin with, which isn't much by today's standards, but back then
it sounds a lot for them.
Which escalated to $22 million,
right?
Because as I was saying at the top of the podcast, that most of it was shot on location,
right? Yeah.
Which is phenomenally expensive, particularly when you're in a location that's very adverse, like the jungle. And it made domestically $5.9 million in the United States and $9 million internationally. So it didn't recoup its budget.
Right. And do you think that's just because it was totally the wrong film to make?
I think there are two things. Well, I mean, I suppose you could say there are many things, but I'm going to focus on two things that I think...
Two problems with it.
Two problems.
Okay, hit me.
The first one is that it was released in the same week as Star Wars.
Right.
And obviously, they're completely different films, and you get a completely different audience going to them. But Star Wars had crossover appeal, and it was the first... I think probably after Jaws, let's say the second blockbuster film of the 1970s. Was Star Wars, and some observers see this as the start of the decline of sort of the new Hollywood brat directors, and the rise of people like Lucas and Spielberg et al. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
So they're not brats. What are they then?
Well, no, sorry, I used the wrong thing there. The movie brats were Lucas and Spielberg.
Okay, okay. It's the decline of the old guard.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, although Friedkin wasn't old at that time at all. You know, he's still making movies now.
Yeah.
But he wasn't making blockbuster movies. He wasn't making event movies. He was making gritty. And this, you know, Sorcerer follows the grittiness and... power of the French Connection and The Exorcist, you know, it complies with his worldview of those two things.
Mm.
But people just weren't interested in it.
Mm. I mean, but you are.
I like it a lot. I mean, I hadn't seen it until a couple of years ago, but I'd heard about it for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, read about it in movie magazines like Empire, which I subscribe to, and read about it online. And then finally, when this restored version was released, I was, you know, first in line to get a copy.
So it sounds like what you like about it is the texture of it, in terms of like the visual texture, but also the kind of emotional texture.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Visually, it's very, very interesting. And it does have something to get your teeth into. You know, it's not it's not just surface.
Mm-hmm.
You are in for the journey with these people.
Right.
And I think particularly the Roy Scheider, the guys on the run from the mob, and the French banker are the two that you identify. Well, not identify with, but they're the most clearly drawn characters of the four
mm-hmm.
men. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention actually that the terrorist, his bomb making skills come in useful.
Right.
When their path is blocked after they've crossed the river on the rickety bridge, their path is blocked by a massive fallen tree.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy Scheider kind of loses his cookies and starts hacking at the jungle, saying, "We can go around it. We can go around it. I can cut through the jungle," which he clearly can't. And then the terrorist guy takes a look at the tree and says, "I can get us through this."
So it's a little bit like a heist movie.
Yeah, a little bit. Although, you know, most heist movies, you're kind of rooting for them, and
they work well together.
Yeah,
you know, there's tension, but then they.
Whereas these guys just hate each other. They just don't like each other at all.
Anyway, I think I interrupted you halfway through your two things.
Okay. Oh yes. So the first one was the fact that it was released at the same time as Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
and the second thing is that although it. Although it is, you know, texturally and visually interesting, it's not really a mainstream film. You know, it's kind of an art movie in many ways.
What is it about it that makes it that?
I think the lack of dialogue is one thing.
Okay.
So it's not, I mean, there is dialogue in it, but there ain't much, you know,
it's very
dialogue light. The lack of dialogue, the way it's shot, you know, if we think about, you know, I was comparing the way it's shot to the way that Robert Altman used to shoot movies, and Altman had a couple of hits, but you know, he was largely, you know, largely not a commercial film director, Robert Altman. You know, he was a worthy
he seemed to be
guy.
Deliberately pulling you out of the characters. And,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that, okay, so a word just came to me actually as I was thinking about that. It's a bit alienating. It's also.
Right.
That. Yeah.
That's almost what it's about, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is. In the way that, in the same way that Requiem for a Dream is alienating to a massive degree, so is Sorcerer.
Right, right, right.
And to the cinema goer who makes up most of the box office, that's not going to work.
Yeah. So is it about the Wages of Fear? Is that what it's called, the book?
Yeah. So the book is called The Wages of Fear.
What's it about? Is it about the wages of fear? And if so, what does that mean?
I don't really know. I'd really like to see the 1953 film, because everything I've read about online of everybody who's got an opinion about Sorcerer says that The Wages of Fear is a better movie.
Right, okay.
So I'd really like to see that. Maybe we could talk about that in a future podcast. Mm.
What's it about? Yeah.
What's it about? It's about alienation. It's about people who have done bad things in their lives and ended up somewhere and have the chance for a bit of redemption, to do something right. But at the same time, they're also not altruistic about it. They are actually looking to get out of where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about a second chance for these people, in a way.
Which either they blow or
doesn't
work out.
Yeah, it's kind of a last chance, second chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and then to follow on.
Yes.
From what is it about?
Mm.
What's the point of it? Why is it good? Why is the world a better place?
Why is the world
because it exists?
Why is the world a better place for this film? Well, the Tangerine Dream soundtrack, for one thing, is the world is a better place for that. I think the world is always a better place for another William Friedkin movie.
Because it gives you a window onto the gritty reality of reality.
Yeah, yeah. And I enjoy the gritty reality of reality in a film.
Yeah.
In the same way that I enjoy a bit of escapism.
Yeah.
Which we'll go into in a future podcast with another film that I watched recently that I really enjoyed. But I won't tell you what it is yet.
I find films with gritty reality to be good places to escape sometimes.
Yes, I think so too. You know, equally, I enjoy watching something like Jurassic World or Mad Max Fury Road.
I have a TV series which is like catnip for me.
What's that?
Which is The Walking Dead.
I love The Walking Dead.
I cannot get enough of it. And when it's on, I'm captivated. And when it stops, I just want more.
That's super gritty and realistic, isn't it? And well, in terms of a zombie apocalypse.
It's obviously massively escapist or fantasy, but it's also got the kind of trappings of gritty realism, and something about the formula that they've put together is just highly addictive for me.
I think a lot of that has to do with the cast. Is really, really good.
Right. Yeah.
And if it wasn't for them, I don't think it would be as compelling as it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it gets wearing after a while that they're just in yet another. Anyway, why are we talking about The Walking Dead?
I don't know.
Just because of gritty.
We were talking about gritty realism.
It's the escapism of grittiness.
Yes.
It's hard to call that realism, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
It's so like that, emotionally real.
That's where Sorcerer. But at the same time, although Sorcerer is emotionally real and gritty, it also has this, as I was talking about earlier, has this weird, slightly surreal tone to it.
Right, yeah.
And The Jungle is a bit like that, having been to The Jungle. It is a bit surreal and a bit strange.
Yeah.
Like nowhere else I've ever been, really. Mm. In fact, a lot of South America's like that. It's very strange. Not a strange place, but just seems very different.
Mm.
To anything that I've ever seen before.
The other question I had is whether the film sort of shows through any of the prevailing attitudes about Colombia at that time. You know, does it? I'm not sure how people felt about South America at that point. Did they feel like it was a totally alien place?
Yeah, I mean, what we knew about South America at that time was that they had a lot of trouble with, governments rising and falling very quickly, and a lot of instability and civil war and that kind of thing.
Their presidents kept getting assassinated.
Yes, exactly. So
American agents.
That's what we heard about. The reality is that it appears that life is kind of mundane in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of money. It rains a lot in the rainforest, not surprisingly. The police appear to be feckless and easy to bribe if you've got the right money. I suppose it's
pretty much our perception of South America now.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Although I think these days South America is very different to how it was back then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our perception, in terms of our movie, portrayal of South America is basically it's just a kind of place where you can escape to because it's lawless. Mm. That's the kind of.
But you run the risk of getting into trouble locally.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Or being blown up.
Or being blown up by nitroglycerin, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's Sorcerer.
Thank you very much. It sounds. Do I want to watch it?
I don't know. Do you?
Yeah. I mean, Yeah.
Excellent.
It sounds like I'd like it. I don't think I'm going to make an effort to watch it.
I think you would like it. I think we should talk about The French Connection.
Well, I definitely think I've come out of this thinking I should watch The French Connection.
I think you should. I think French Connection is one of those movies that if you haven't seen it and you've seen a lot of other cop films or cop TV shows, you watch The French Connection and you think, oh, okay, this is where the template came from.
Yeah, right, yeah.
This is the buddy cop relationship. This is the hardened cop who, breaks the rules and that kind of thing.
Back then,
it wasn't a cliche.
Yeah, yeah.
And Gene Hackman is just incredible in The French Connection. You know, it's,
fantastic.
Yeah,
and I think also I should look out for other Friedkin things.
There's
and
another
watch
good
The Exorcist
one.
Again.
Yeah, well, it's always a good time to watch The Exorcist. There's another good one called To Live and Die in L.A., which is an 80s Friedkin with Willem Dafoe, which is very, very good indeed. He had a bit of a dry patch for a while. And he's made a couple of good things recently. He made a film called Bug with can't remember, Michael Shannon, is it? And more recently, a film called Killer Joe with Matthew McConaughey.
I've heard of that.
Which I found to be very disturbing, which is a good thing. You know, it sort of got under my skin a bit.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you. So that's Sorcerer.
Yes.
Just time for a little bit of plugging.
Oh, yeah, plugging.
If you go to the Good Robot Andy's website, which you can find by using your favourite search engine and typing in The Good Robot Andy.
Because there's nothing else called The Good Robot Andy's.
There's nothing else. No one else would call anything The Good Robot anything, to be honest.
Why would you?
No. Yeah. If you click on the About button in the top right-hand corner, you'll find some links to other stuff that Andy and I do. Andy, you do a radio show?
I do. I present a radio show on Glastonbury FM, which is where I live in Somerset in England. That's on Thursday between 6 and 7 in the evening. And that's called Andy's Movie Mashup, and I play a lot of soundtrack music. I also play sort of new stuff that I like that I think is good, and I review.
You get to choose basically whatever music you like, is that right?
Yeah, there's no playlist. I just pick stuff out and play it, which is
that's amazing,
which is fantastic.
So
I do that and this,
and no spoilers in that, of course.
No,
at this point in the podcast, we should warn the listener that
it's too late.
That this podcast contains spoilers.
It's too late for that.
Yeah, so you may have picked that up, listener.
If you didn't, we're very sorry. Actually, no, we're not sorry.
Well, yeah, we're not sorry. You should have listened to the other 6 episodes.
Yes. What do you do, Andy? You do a whole bunch of stuff, don't you?
Yeah, I do lots of computery stuff. You can find, if you look at that About page, you can find links to videos on programming. And the most recent thing I've done is a little game called Rabbit Escape on Android.
Oh, my wife loves Rabbit Escape.
Which is very gratifying. There are more levels coming for it, so, you know, get in there early and buy it, and then you'll find more levels coming through your way.
Yes, Rabbit Escape is very good indeed.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. No one's really buying it, but we're having a lot of fun writing it. I've got a couple of people who've joined in with me to write levels and write code for it, so that's brilliant fun. I'm loving that.
Excellent.
The other thing I was going to say was we are attempting in this episode to improve our sound quality. We're aware that it hasn't been brilliant. We're trying out a different setup. So do let us know, especially if you've given up on the podcast and haven't downloaded this episode because of the previous sound quality problems. We would like you to give us feedback telling us that you haven't listened to this episode because of the previous sound quality.
How would they know? Because they haven't downloaded it.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, if you bump into Kenneth Branagh and he's talking about it, maybe he'll mention to you.
He likes a brand of chocolate. It comes with two fingers. Might be a Kit Kat or something like that, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's just a bit of trivia.
Wow. You live in this showbiz world. I'm absolutely blown away. anyway, I know Ken goes on about it a lot. So if you bump into Ken and he's talking about it, you know, just give it another chance. Because we're trying to improve
the
sound quality.
I saw him the other day, actually. Do you know what he said?
What did he say?
Who are you?
He said, get off my lawn.
Get off my lawn. He got his shotgun out. No, he didn't. He doesn't have a shotgun. I wasn't on his lawn and I didn't see him.
Yeah, he's got a nice beard.
He has got a nice beard.
Yeah. So hello to Ken.
Yes, hello to Ken Brenner. That's going to be our meme. You know, Kermo de Mayo got hello to Jason Isaacs. We've got hello to Ken Brenner.
Yeah. It's better if yeah. I mean, Kermode and Mayo are saying hello to him because he listens.
Yeah, and he's a friend of Mark Kermode, so they went to school together. He went to school with Jason Isaacs.
Yeah.
I didn't go to school with Kenneth Branagh.
No, but you were. You did bump into him the other day and talk to him about Chocolate Fingers.
I didn't, actually. Oh. No, but I'm not going to go into how I know about that.
I think we'd better stop there.
Yeah, I think we probably should.
We'll see you next time.
Yeah, thank you.